After the horrific murder of George Floyd, the subsequent protests, and the dark underbelly that came to light thanks to the Black Lives Matter movement, I have been looking for an expert to teach me and our audience how to raise anti-racist children and how to be anti-racist. So today's guest is Dr. Tracy Baxley. She's a professor, a consultant, a parenting coach, a speaker, a mother to five biracial children, and the author of the brand new book, Social Justice Parenting, How to Raise Compassionate, Anti-Racist, Justice-Minded Kids in an Unjust World. She's an absolute expert. She's an educator and has been for over 30 years with degrees in child development, elementary education, and curriculum and instruction. She specializes in diversity, inclusion, anti-bias curriculum, and social justice education. We have a very vulnerable and candid conversation. And my goal for this podcast is really just to equip you with the tools. I'm learning, I'm listening, and hopefully this conversation is beneficial to you as well. Tracy, oh my goodness, I've been looking forward to this interview for so long. Thank you so much for spending the time with me on your book tour, your new book, Social Justice Parenting, How to Raise Compassionate, Anti-Racist, Justice-Minded Kids in an Unjust World. Man, it like gives my whole body chills, like so timely, this information. And you're the mom of air change agent teaching us all how to do the hard work. So thank you for being here and spending your time with me today.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Kelly, for having me. I know the book title is a little bit of a mouthful, but we were trying to get everything in to really kind of show you right up front what we're trying to do in the book. And it's all about our babies, right?
Right. And we always say we're raising the next generation, but I would say as a parent, I'm learning how to be a parent. And I'm really looking to experts like you to teach me how to do that, especially looking back on last year, 2020, Black Lives Matters, these big horrific events that were put all over the news. And, you know, we're standing up together and trying to like kind of like strip away and learn, you know, unlearn and just try to be better. And I just like, I want to pour into my boys the love that I feel for like all colors, all races, all genders. But I, you know, I'm realizing like everyone's raised with bias and everyone's raised in specific communities that maybe teaches us stuff that we don't even realize. So I just can't thank you enough for this work, but I'm just here to learn and really let you be the expert. Cause I'm definitely not. And I just want to be, when it comes to sleep, I go to the sleep experts. And when it comes to education, I go to the education experts. You know, when it comes to food, I know that exposure is really important. And I know that trying again and talking about things is really important, but I want to tell your whole story. So let's start from the beginning. How did you first start working in child development and education, and how did you start focusing on social justice?
Yeah, I think it's always been in me. You know, from the time that I was little, I was that child who had a lot of different friends and a lot of different groups. And I was always drawn in my early years of education. When I first graduated, I majored in elementary education, child development, and I was always drawn to those kids who didn't belong, right? Who didn't have the friends, who was maybe socially awkward or something where they didn't feel like they fit in. And it's kind of been, maybe because I'm an empath, so that bothered me always when I would see the one child or the group of children who didn't feel like they had a place. And I think that is kind of maybe the foundation for the work that I do that started me really being interested in why those children were not being accepted and what can the other children do to really kind of embrace people who are different. And so it was kind of my mission as a teacher to say, okay, let's fix this as a teacher. And then when I went back to get my doctorate degree, it just was a natural place for me to start. So the courses that I teach at the university are multicultural education and curriculum courses. And when I became a mom, I think my children are biracial. So they, you know, they have a uniqueness in terms of belonging and fitting in and identity as well. So I started thinking about as a mother, how do I make sure that my children find belonging, you know, within And then how do I raise children who also will be those kids that always make everybody else feel like they belong? And then it just kind of has grown into more of, you know, I'm not just worrying about my own kids, but I also feel like the world is a village. And I think we all need to be pouring into each other's children. And so, you know, that's kind of how everything unfolded, really. I really think as a child, it's always been kind of in me.
Well, if you're an empath and you're feeling that loneliness or that separation from the group, you're feeling what those children feel, then how could you not want to be the person to help create change for them? And so as parents, like when we look at raising children and we want, obviously, I want compassionate little boys. I want sensitive, feminine little boys. I want boys who like want everyone to be included. And I don't want them to exclude people. Where do we start with inclusion of all races and genders? And yeah, as parents, how do we cultivate?
I think it starts with us, right? First of all, there is, I think, let me just back up and say, social justice parenting is really this way that we kind of intentionally, purposefully show up as parents, where we're raising children who care deeply for others, who love radically, who show up for others. And I think I believe social justice parenting is kind of the antidote to fear-based parenting. And oftentimes when we're new parents or we're in new situations, we enter this space of fear-based parenting really for similar reasons, right? We want to protect our kids. We want to keep them safe. We want the world to be safe around them. We don't really want to mess up as parents. And that fear kind of keeps us from looking beyond our homes or our communities, right? It really kind of sometimes gets in the way because we're always trying to do the right things by our children. But I think in doing that, sometimes we begin to stifle who they can be. We begin to lessen the opportunities and the impact they can really make, even as young children. So I think that the first thing we do as parents, we have to reflect on our own experiences, our childhoods, any biases or stereotypes we hold about other groups of people, and really examine those deeply. And I know in our own childhoods, there's some things that our parents did wonderfully, but there's some things in our past that our moms and dads may not have done well or not developed as much in us. And so we want to be really mindful of those things because we want to consciously bring in those things that we know will serve us as parents. And just as consciously, how do I break the cycle? How do I change things that were different? And I think part of that is creating core values in your home. Like, what are the things that I want my kids, no matter what, to grow up knowing is true? And those core values should always lead you in all the decisions that you're making about your kids and for your children. It's not saying that we're perfect, right? Because I do a lot of things that I have to check myself to say, is that part of your core values? But I think if you establish core values with your family early, it can serve almost like a compass or a GPS to always bring you back when you're making the bigger decisions, the harder decisions, those decisions that bring a lot of fear in you. Does me teaching this to my children help us develop those core values? And if the answer is yes, then I need to figure out a way that I'm teaching that.
I love that so much. I feel like really teaching your kids to be anti-racist, and I want you to, you know, teach our listeners how to do that. I mean, last year it was just like break your heart open kind of conversations and just bringing things to the surface and listening, lots of listening. And I mean, things came up for me about my childhood. Like, I grew up in Southern California in Orange County in a little, in like a bubble, you know, with not a lot of diversity. And I played with Barbie dolls, you know, and my Barbie dolls were like that pink plastic, you know, and there was not a lot of diversity there. And so just even going through last year and looking at the books that we have and buying books like Parker Looks Up, you know, that's like an amazing book about a little Black girl who goes to the museum and sees Michelle Obama, you know, and a beautiful picture on the wall. And it's like, you know, just to have that book and to have pictures of those little kids for Sebastian and to look at like the toys that he had, like I immediately, he loves little people. And I'm like, okay, like now I'm going to buy him the house because he has the farm and he has the school. So I bought the house with Chris and Tessa, you know, it's like, it wouldn't have been something I wasn't raised to like buy the black little people, but I was like, wait, I am like this. I know food and I know exposure to food and I'm going to bring in all different colors and shapes and sizes of all the different veggies. But like, I need to do that in other aspects of life, but I feel comfortable with food. And so I don't know if I'm doing this right or, you know, how to do it, but I want to do it right. I really want to do it right. And I want him to have exposure to all different types of people. And I want the tools and I want our listeners to have the tools to be anti-racist and to teach their children how to be anti-racist, more importantly, because this generation is, they're going to be the next best generation and they're going to raise an even better generation. So what am I doing right? What am I doing wrong? What else do I need to be doing? Like I just can't, all of us mama bears out there, I just want to protect our children and and help each other protect our children. So how do we do that?
I think in the protecting sometimes is where we go wrong, because when you're keeping your kids so protected, and I also say this, right? If you have the gift really to be able to protect your kids from some of those negative things in the world, then you know, you have, that's a privilege, right?
Right.
That's something that you have, if you have a choice in that. There's some of us, just, you know, being a black mother, I don't really have that choice. I have to talk to my children about race. I have to talk to them about what that feels like in their body, the positives and the things that could be negative in the world, right? And so I think if, first of all, to think about if you have a choice that you don't have to have those conversations, that shows you that there's a need for the conversation. I also think that what you're doing in terms of using your knowledge with food as a reference point for how you want to do the same for diversity in your world, in terms of people and experiences, I think that's a great idea. And I would use a lot of those tools that you just named and how you are presenting that to your children about the diversity of people. But I really think that when we're talking about anti-racist work, I think it's really important to do exactly what you're doing in terms of reflection. Like, what didn't I get? What do I know now that I didn't know then? Because when I work with clients or if I'm doing workshops, I have one of the activities I have moms, mostly moms, do is to write down all the memories that they have about conversations about race that they had with their families, about being that race. And obviously, my name is not so obvious, but oftentimes my white clients, their paper's blank, right? Like there was no sit down, heart to heart, eye to eye conversation about race.
Yeah.
But all of my families of color, you know, I have to say, okay, time up. You know, it's time to stop writing, because those were conversations that were had often in families of color. And so I think by doing nothing at all is probably the only way to do it wrong.
Right.
So it's going to be uncomfortable work, and that's great because it's pushing you to learn more, to extend your knowledge, to not have all the right answers. And that's great. Those are great lessons to teach our kids, that we're not going to always get it right. We're not going to sometimes we may offend people. You're showing them how to apologize, how to make it right, and do it differently. So don't let the fear stop you from starting. Don't let the feelings of being uncomfortable about not knowing what to say or how to say it be the reason that you do nothing, because I think in the long run, that would be the only way that I would say it's doing it wrong.
Right.
So, you know, be okay with making the mistakes and not knowing, and living in that space is okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's exactly like I've been thinking about this interview for so long, because I'm like, I know I'm going to make a mistake. Like, I'm like, I feel like I've been trying to listen so hard and read and like get the books that I'm supposed to have for my children. And like, for myself and to try and just push myself. But you're exactly right. Like if we sat down and I had to write like how many conversations I had about my race, I didn't. And I don't want my, you know, if I were raising a little girl and she was in your workshop as a mom, like I would want her to say like, you know, I had the privilege to not have to have that conversation. But what my parents taught me was that, you know, like that is innately biased and I need to learn how to like lift others up and support others mm-hmm. and be aware of this to be better.
Yeah. Because the only way we're going to change the world really is together. Like we're stronger together, right?
Right.
I need you to raise your children in a certain way so that you see my children, and I need to raise my children not to be afraid of your children.
Right.
So it's important that we're all doing the work, no matter what our race or background is, we all have a role to play in how we raise the next generation of children who are going to be change agents in the world.
And that's exactly why you wrote this book. And I'm so thankful that you did, because we need tools like this. Let's take a minute to talk about my favorite sparkling beverage, Sound Tea. Sound Tea makes bubbles infused with only organic tea, botanicals, and fruit extracts. So you can say goodbye to sugar and artificially sweetened drinks without missing the sweetness. They're 100% certified organic, completely unsweetened, and they create way more fun and unique flavors than most traditional sparkling waters. For example, their blueberry, cinnamon, and hibiscus tea is one of my all-time favorites. It's also perfect if you have a soda problem because they have caffeinated tea options. So if you're a client of mine, we'd immediately replace that soda habit with a caffeinated Sound Tea. And then for someone who needs a caffeine-free option, for example, I loved their sparkling chamomile tea when I was pregnant. It sort of tastes like a vanilla soda. It's delicious. And I've used their sparkling rose tea to replace a rosé habit to pull that alcohol. So there are so many uses for Sound Tea, and I'm so proud of the owners for sticking to their guns and never using artificial or natural flavors, only using organic extracts, organic teas that are loaded with polyphenols, and really offering an elevated option for sparkling beverages. So if you guys want to give Sound Tea a try, head to drinksound.com and use the code BeWell20 for 20% off your entire order online. Now, if you don't want to buy them online, head to select Whole Foods stores or any Erewhon store to snag a can or a glass bottle and give it a try yourself. So if parents are listening and they want to start their anti-racist journey with their children, what are the first steps that you obviously have a conversation, but do you have some advice for them in regards to how they look at their past and how they start to enact change in their future?
Yes. I call it the four S's of anti-racist parenting work, right? Just to make it simple, right?
Love so an acronym or like a tool, a tip, give me the S's, the C's, whatever it is. Yeah.
So okay. The four S's are self-reflection, mm-hmm. survey, speak, and seek. So the self-reflection is what we've always been talking, what we've already talked about, right? Is it examining your own biases, examining any experiences that you've had with people who are different from you that may have made you think a certain way or feel a certain way. You have to really unpack that and be honest about that, which is often hard work. Like when I work with clients, that's the one that they often want to skip. Like, okay, I got it. But that's when the work starts, because that's the way you start, determines how you start showing up as a parent. So really do some work and unpacking where you stand, how you feel, how those experiences from your childhood or your feelings are showing up in your parenting, right? So that may take some journaling, some writing, some really unpacking to do that. That self-reflection is the first piece. The second piece is survey. So this is kind of like what you were saying, like looking around my home, looking around my community to see what's really there. What decision did I make for A that's now impacting Z? So for example, if you bought a house in a neighborhood that you thought was a great neighborhood, right? You look around your neighborhood and you realize everybody looks the same. So those same people are now going to this particular school. So in that school, they all look the same. and then you're going to play some sports, dance, or whatever, and they're all come from the same pool. So one decision that you've made has now trickled into many areas of your life where you have kind of set your kid up to be around the same kind of people. So you need to survey those parts in your home, in your community, or in your life that really maybe not aligned to really raising kids who are anti-racist. So that may be starting at the low-hanging fruit, like you said, or checking your bookshelves, checking your toys, checking the play groups that you are in. So those things are really important, and those are pretty easy to do. The other thing, when you've done that, then I think you should look outside of your home into your community. Where is there diversity? If there's not, who do I need to talk to make some changes? Like, what do I say to my principal if I want my kids to have a curriculum that's a little bit more, like, who do I need to talk to in the city council that may connect us with somebody else? What groups are in our neighborhood or close to our neighborhood that we can now visit or make some kind of connection with? So that whole surveying of what's going on around your community. The next thing is the seek part. So this is where you are really starting to expose your kids to differences. So maybe it's, you know, various restaurants, maybe it's cultural events, maybe it's after school activities, your sporting events. Like, you know, maybe the dance class right down the street is a better dance class. Maybe it's not. Maybe I could check 20 minutes down the street to see if I can get my child on a baseball team or a sporting event or dance, music, tutoring, whatever that may include a little bit more diversity. So you're seeking out opportunities where you can kind of create some more diverse areas in your kids' lives. And then the other one is speak. I think I said it wrong, but the speak is really starting to have those open dialogues with your children. Like, you're talking about what's going on in the world. You're talking about the books that you're reading. You're talking about what is important to your family in terms of your core values and how your family can position themselves to support or empower other groups of people. And so those are the four areas that I think that you can start with in terms of your anti-racist journey. I also want to say one thing too, Kelly, about, I know oftentimes this idea of privilege comes up, and I want to kind of spin it on its head just a little bit, because this is always a space that people get a little nervous about. I want us to start looking at privilege as one, our various identities, right? So people are really using this idea of white privilege as kind of a weapon, right? Or something to be afraid of, something to feel guilty about, or it's putting people at odds and on edge. And I would just challenge your listeners to look at privilege in a multitude of identities. So for example, I'm a Black woman, and those are two areas in my life based on the identities in the United States right now, right? We know they're all socially constructed. So, but right now, those two identities are marginalized, right? They're not the dominant or the identities that have more power.
Right.
But as a middle class or upper middle class family, that's an area that I have privilege. Yeah. And so then I have to ask my family, my kids, how are we using that privilege and that identity that is bringing up somebody else? How are we supporting? How are we empowering? How are we lending our voice to help support? And so race and white privilege is just one of many identities that we hold. So I don't want people to get so hung up and have this tension around that identity, when there's so many different identities that we can have that we're either marginalized in or that we hold power and space in. So it's about sharing that space and sharing that power with other people who may not have it in that identity, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense, because it's exactly, you know, when you talk about self-reflection and just looking at yourself, I mean, it is like, what, having white privilege. You know, I have the female part with you, but I am white, and I, you know, that gives me white privilege, and not having to talk about race when I was little. I mean, it does make me feel uncomfortable. Like I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed that there wasn't more diversity. And I freaked out last year and was like, this can't be my child's future. Like I need to follow the four S's. I need to get my children involved and have the diversity that maybe I wasn't raised with in my school, but maybe I saw on the soccer field because it was like a larger group of girls and from a larger area. And so I love that you say that because there's other things. Like for me, it's the education and nutrition. Like how can I be lending this knowledge that I have to communities that don't have that? Or maybe it is, you know, I wasn't at a place financially to support other people other than my family at a certain point, but now I am, you know, and like, how am I able to take my business and give back in the space where it can be in marginalized communities where they have a food desert? Like that feels so authentic to me. And that's how I feel like I can show up. But you're exactly right. Like just that feeling of, oh, there's a lot of tension here. What if I do this wrong? Or now I'm embarrassed because of this. And instead of having it feel like a weapon, maybe say like, well, I'm a prism. What are the other little reflector points and how can I help? I love that.
Yeah. And I love what you just said about, because nutrition, right, is a core value for your family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now you're using what's important to your family to then give back to the world. And I think in that space, I think that's exactly where you can start. What's important to you, what you have experience in, where you're the expert, where somebody else may need to be supported.
It just feels aligned to me. I love that. Yeah, it's good. Okay, I have so many more questions where to start. So can we talk about your own experience? You have biracial children and you mentioned that earlier. And you said finding themselves in themselves and finding like safety and security in that home and knowing who they are as an individual is wonderful and powerful and beautiful. Can you talk about how you have raised your kids and coached your kids and taught your kids to love themselves and their differences?
Yeah. Yeah. And listen, it ain't been easy.
Continue. Yeah. You're continuing to do it every day.
Yes. Yes. One thing about in our house, we obviously my husband's white. And so our kids are biracial and we talk about what that means in the house. My kids, as they were growing up, use different terms to describe themselves and they weren't always the same. And that was fine. You know, I always say that my kids can self-identify in the house however they choose, but I also teach them what they need to know when they're in the world, because people are going to see them as Black and all that comes with that, you know, the joys and sometimes the pains of that. And so we are raising our kids to know they are biracial, but they're Black in the world. So that was very difficult. I'm thinking about my older two, because as you know better, you do better, right? So I've raised my last three a little bit different than I did with my first two, because I didn't know, you know, I wanted them to grow up without lack. Where we moved, the sports they play, all the things I'm saying, I wasn't great at that, but my daughter, who's the oldest. And I think part of that, I didn't recognize that until she was a little bit older, that I needed to really diversify her daily experiences. We had extended family, obviously, that were Black. We had Black friends, but when her day-to-day in our neighborhood, there were not any other Blacks. And so I've had to learn from her experiences, poor thing, she's like the guinea pig, right, that first one, that I didn't do enough, even though we talked about it a lot, and she saw Black people, it wasn't enough for her. So she really went through a little bit of identity crisis, trying to figure out where she fit in. And so one thing that we always taught our kids, we have this open dialogue policy that home is safe, right? Safe space. We can talk about anything, even if it's stuff that we don't want to hear as parents, you can talk about it. And, you know, sometimes I have to ask my kids, especially the older ones, am I listening as a friend because you need to vent? Or am I, you know, do I have my mama bear ears on where I need to try to help you and guide you through it and give you advice or work through things? So establishing that kind of safe space first, like sometimes they just want to say it. They don't want you to comment on it. But I think one of the skills that we taught our kids early was this idea of self-advocacy, of really being able to recognize your needs, know who those players are in your village that can help you with those needs, and ways to get those needs met. And I think a lot of that ties back into the anti-racist work, because sometimes if I'm asking my kids to do something or go with me someplace, they can say to me, it's too much for me, Mom. Right now, I don't want to do that, or going there, it's too much for me mentally, or whatever that is, or I don't want to talk about that right now. And so them creating those boundaries, when they use them on me, it makes me happy, because I realize that they've learned that. And it's important, because then I know when they brought into the world, they'll be able to use those same boundaries that they use on me, or that they feel safe using.
That's got to feel hard to hear sometimes when they don't want to talk about something or be somewhere, that it may feel too heavy for them. But wow, like how empowering that must feel to you to know, like, wow, I've raised children who have boundaries, can have boundaries with their parents, which means they're going to be able to go out there in the world and have boundaries with people if something doesn't feel right. How do you start laying that groundwork of them understanding, being comfortable setting boundaries with you, and you're respecting those? Like, what does that day-to-day look like?
I think it starts with establishing that space, safe space, and open dialogue, right? Okay. Sometimes we would have like the popsicle sticks in the mason jar, and we pull them out for question starters, conversation starters. Sometimes it would be silly things. Sometimes they'd be very serious things. And so I think establishing that we can have conversations and nobody gets in trouble and everybody's being heard is really the first part of that. I also went through periods as a parent where, like, my daughter really is the one who tells me a lot now that she's older. She's 21 now. There were times growing up that she felt like the things that we thought were opportunities for her were really too much. You're going to play the travel soccer, and you're going to do the dance, and you're going to do and you should take those classes and piano lessons. And she felt like she had to be good at all of those things. And when she wasn't, that she felt like she wasn't good enough. And so that's the other caution, right? Is to not overindulge in opportunities that we think are good for them, but that they should have some say and some decisions about when something is too much.
Right.
And so I think that was also where she did not have the boundaries to say, this is too much. She was just trying to do it all. And so I think having those dialogues and talking about them is a way to really starting with small conversations and small issues. So when they get older and the issues get bigger, you have established this open line of communication with your children that when the boundaries are fuzzy, they come to you and you can help walk them through that. So I think the open dialogue and continually having intentional times when your kids are talking with you and you listening, which is hard because we want to fix everything, is really important to establishing these same kids who will be good listeners out in the world. I always say, like, creating belonging in our homes so that we're raising children who are creating belonging for others in the world. So again, goes back to the core values of what's important to you. Are you living by those core values? And if you're not, what pivots do you need to take in order for your kids to really, because that's really the legacy, right? It's not the material things. It's not the wealth. It's really like those core concepts of what's important to us about being a person who gives back, who is compassionate and kind. What are the foundations that we are putting in place that they will take those to them when they're adults, when they're parents, and when they're working out in the world?
It's a beautiful legacy to leave behind. And I think when you explain that type of parenting, it's a secure attachment parenting, that safe and seen, like making sure that your children, I just picture them in this, the little safe bubble of your house of like, you're not going to get in trouble. I can listen or I can give advice, but I'm here and I'm just present with you. I can see them just being an extension of you out in the world and being that, that person for all of their friends and their coworkers. And it's just, it's really, really beautiful. Can you talk to me a little bit about, I want to do two things. I want to talk about core values, what your family's core values are, how to establish core values. And then I'd love to talk about raising compassionate and kind children.
So we have in my social justice parenting program, the first module we do is I make everybody establish core values. Like if you haven't done that in your family yet, you can't move on into that stuff.
Do not pass go. Right. Do not collect $200.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
I like it to, if you have older kids, it's really great to establish it with them.
Okay.
What do you think is important to us? What do we need to be doing in the world and really have it so that they feel like they're empowered to help too? I also like to put it in words that is kind of catchy for the kids to remember so that they own it, right? And they could call you on it when you're not doing it. So a couple of ours are, you are your brother's keeper, right? So, or your sister's keeper. But it's about always family first, always having each other's backs, always picking each other up, always calling each other to the carpet when we need to be called. And that family is, this is safe, right? When all else falls away, this is who we got. And you need to be valuing that and showing that every day. So your brother or sister's keeper is one of ours. Another one is own your own junk. So this is where, you know, when my kids are complaining about or telling me that somebody else did something, I always say own your own junk first. Like, don't tell me about what he or she did to you. I need to know what do you think you did in that situation? Or tell me what you think they will be coming to say to me first. And then we can unpack what really happened. And so sometimes when my kids were younger and I'd say, own your own junk first, they would think about it and realize I'm not even going to bother, right?
Yeah. They're like, shoot, mom's got me. Yes.
So sometimes they can reflect on it enough to think, okay, maybe I did have a part in that. And it's not worth telling, you know, but sometimes it's like something that happened at school that they really need to talk about. But I do get them to think about it from their own, what they contributed to it or looking at it from somebody else's perspective first, before they can then say, well, this is how I felt. So those are two of our core values that, so I like to put it so that we can kind of call each other on it each time. And it becomes natural language in our house where we're talking about core values without saying these are our core values, you know.
I like that. I might steal "you are your brother's keeper" because I can just see my little boys growing up and
yes,
you know, taking it, wrestling and taking each other out and making fun of each other, you know, not treating each other the way you want them to. And
yeah,
that's like really important to me. It's like I want Sebastian to protect his little brother. And if Toshin ends up bigger than Sebastian, I want Toshin to protect Sebastian. You know, it's, you know, not to say like you want to raise your kids and say the world is a scary place, but you know, don't watch the news right now. Cause it feels like a really scary place.
Listen, and I have to turn it off too. Like I get to where like I feel physically overwhelmed.
Yeah. That's your boundaries. You have to have,
yes.
I read, and I actually said this on another podcast, but I read this awesome quote that was something about how we weren't meant to take on the world's problems. We were meant to protect the people of our village and our community and our family. And, you know, it's technology. You can see people all over the world, all the good, all the bad. And unfortunately, the bad stuff tends to be like really clickbaity. It's really great headlines and it can be overwhelming for a lot of us. But I love that. You are your brother's keeper just keeps it and own your own junk. But you are your brother's keeper really feels like you're focusing on your family first and that safe haven in your home. And then you go out. It's like putting your own oxygen mask on first. It's taking care of
absolutely.
It's taking care of yourself and your family first and then going out.
I've spent the last decade educating my clients, friends, family, and followers all about how their food choices impact their blood glucose. We know from research that poor glucose control is tied to a number of chronic conditions, including Alzheimer's, diabetes, heart disease, stroke, weight gain, fatigue, and sexual dysfunction. This is an enormous problem for our country. There are more than 90 million Americans with prediabetes. 70% of those people will be diabetic within 10 years, and 84% of people with prediabetes don't know they have it. We need a way to give people access to their body's own real-time data so they can make lasting changes and improve their metabolic health. That's where Levels comes in. Levels is expanding access to continuous glucose monitoring, or CGMs, and making it mainstream. They're focused on people looking to optimize their diet, improve metabolic fitness, and increase longevity. They're backed by an amazing team, including a Stanford MD. Check out my interview with Dr. Casey Means on episode 103. I'm so wildly passionate about this company that I invested personally. And that's because for years, I've taught my clients to use traditional glucometers to prick their finger before and after a meal to understand how the food choices that they were making affected them and their glucose personally. Now, CGMs and Levels specifically totally changes that game. It isn't this cumbersome finger pricking situation. You simply wear the CGM and you can immediately know how your food choices affect you, allowing you to optimize those food choices without guessing, getting you to your goals faster. Now, I'm not gonna lie. Blood sugar and glucose management is a hot topic right now, but I've been talking about it for a really long time, and my friends in Levels know that. So they have decided to give me a sneaky website where you can skip a 130,000 person wait list. And that website is levels.link/KellyLevesque. So head on over there, grab a Level CGM, and start making real change immediately. To follow along with my personal Levels experience, check out my highlight on my Instagram at Be Well by Kelly.
So let's talk about compassionate and kind children, because I think, I've been saying this whole podcast, but I really want to raise the most kind and compassionate little humans. Like, that is a, call that my biggest core value. Like, that is so important to me. And you know, you just are like, share, invite that person over, do this, you know, like, it just, I feel like I'm a little bit of a helicopter parent when it comes to that stuff, but how do we do it?
In my book, I talk about it from three different levels, right? Yeah. So the first one is like, when you talk about kindness, compassion, kindness, it's self-compassion, which is, for me, it's the hardest, right? It's the hardest, but it is the role model that our kids are watching. It's the example that they see. So how are you giving yourself grace and space when things aren't going right for you, when you make a mistake, your children are watching, and how you treat yourself in those moments matter. So that's the first thing, modeling it for yourself so that your kids can do it for themselves. And then the second level is really how you're treating your children when they make mistakes, like when they are not feeling supported or things are going wrong in there. So this is about showing up for your children in ways that support them, their growth. Sometimes compassion is hard love too, tough love too, right? So it's teaching them how to pick themselves up when things don't go right, or if they don't make great decisions, you can have compassion, but still teach them lessons, life lessons. So this idea of showing compassion to your kids in ways that it teaches them. And then the third level is, now that they know, right, how do we bring this out into the community? So building these small habits of compassion and kindness in our communities or in the world where our children see us show up for others. And they could be little things like donating clothes and toys, right? Be big things like helping build shelter for people or animals in your community, like, right? So it can show up in different ways. It could be paying for the person behind you in line, right? That's a fun thing that my kids used to love to do when they were younger. So and then we would try to get out of the store or out of the line before they realized it, like that was like the game.
Yeah.
But those kinds of things, they build habits of kindness over a lifetime. And then this idea of being compassionate and kindness, it becomes innate for them. Like, this is the way I was raised. This is what we always do. This is normal. so that they can continue that when they are adults and out in the world without you.
It's so sweet to like picture your kids growing up and being in a grocery store with their kids and paying for the person behind them. Like that just, and I think we overthink things. We think like, oh, we need to have everything in order, but it really is just giving ourselves that grace and space. And I really like number two, like showing them compassion, and especially when we're maybe disciplining them or when they do something wrong. I think that's a really powerful moment for kids too, because the last thing I want is if my children grow up and do something wrong, and in their childhood, doing something wrong meant that they didn't get my compassion and my love, because the last thing I would want is if they were really in trouble for them not to come running to me.
Yeah. And I think too, sometimes it's hard for parents, but part of that raising kind and compassionate human beings is saying no to them. Right. Because studies show that kids who don't get told no often, they, when they become adults, they have less compassion for others because they're used to getting their way. They're used to getting what they want. They're used to the world kind of revolving around them. So part of our jobs or responsibilities as parents is to say no to our kids, even when it's hard sometimes, because it's in that moment that they begin to appreciate it. When you say yes, they don't expect the world to always say yes to them. And then they feel more compassion for people who may not have things because they remember what it feels like to be said no to. So remember, part of that is not giving into your kids' every wish, even when you can.
Oh, that's really good. How and when are you saying no to your kids and still saying it compassionately?
Yes, that's the trick, right? So I know, like, one example is when my youngest son was probably, I don't know, maybe third grade, second or third grade, he wanted a phone because
Gosh, all of his friends
don't have phones. I'm like, you don't need a phone. You're never not with me. And he could not understand that because all of his friends had phones and they were playing the games. And so we had a conversation about why phones were not safe for him. I showed him like studies of like the addiction and why when it's important to get a phone, like when you're away from me and you're going to be doing different things and you need to get in touch with me, but you're never not with me. And so that was hard for me in some senses because he was his only friend at some point without a phone, but it wasn't so hard. And I said, I know you feel sad. I'm sorry you feel sad about that because everybody's doing things that you can't do. You can borrow my phone when you guys are all together, you know, but you're not getting a phone for these reasons. So I acknowledged his feelings of feeling sad and angry. And I think that's one big thing too. That's where the compassion's, you know, even if what our kids is asking for is ridiculous, you still need to say, I understand what you're feeling. I see your feelings. Your feelings are valid. But then be able to say, sorry, kid.
Yeah. I like that. I do think, I mean, I remember growing up in a, you know, like a pretty affluent neighborhood and kids getting brand new cars on their 16th birthday in my school parking lot with a big bow. And I look back on my childhood, my dad owned a towing company. And I remember like really wanting, like, just kind of like, oh yeah, well, everyone gets these and I'm just going to get this car with a bow. And my dad was really good at telling me growing up to that day. He's like, that's not how we do things in our family. Like, that might be something that I could afford for you, but it's still not something I would ever give you. And here are the reasons why. Basically, it doesn't teach you how to like have your, you know, work for something and be raised to like earn something. And like, that's just not the way the world works. I was not handed a car on my 16th birthday, and it's not something you should expect. And I'm really thankful for that. Like, looking back, I had to like work at the tow company and dispatch drivers to cars on the freeway and to high school parking lots where kids would lock their keys in their car.
Those same cars.
Yeah. Like that 16-year-old BMW. Yeah. Your keys are in the same, you know, isn't it a smart car? Shouldn't that key not be allowed to be locked inside that car? But looking back, it was like, I'm really thankful for some of the no's that my parents, like, you know, the big no's, like there, I didn't get a car on my 16th birthday. You know, I was lucky that they were able to support me through my 4-year college degree. But the day I graduated, my dad warned me the whole entire senior year, like, if you don't have something lined up, like the buck stops then, like it's over. Like you have a car, you have a car insurance, like you have gas to pay for your own gas. And I mean, it lit a fire under me for sure. Like looking back, I had to have my job lined up before.
Yeah. One thing that I want to kind of reflect on that your dad did that I really appreciate is the idea of explaining to you why and why that was important to your family. A lot of times parents, you know, they don't take the time to do that because it is time and effort, because I said so, or because I'm the parent, you know, those are things that I know I grew up with because my parents were like, I'm the parent.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really important that if we want to raise children who think critically about things in the world, that we take the time to explain things to them so that they can question. We want to raise people who question status quo. Otherwise, we don't change. And I think that starts with us really being patient with our children to be critical in the answers that we give them, so that they can keep asking those questions when they're out in the world. I know my fourth kid, my son, Ryan, he used to ask like, why all the time? Like, oh my God. Like, and most of the times I did not know the answer to his questions. So we started carrying this spiral notebook, we call it the why book, in the car. Like every time he asks a question, I'd say, write it down. I don't know, write it down. So then we had moments we would start looking up some of the questions. Like, you know, one of the questions I remember was like, why does the grass itch when you roll in the grass? And I'm like, I don't know. But we found out that the blades of grass do micro cuts on your legs or whatever, and that's what causes it to itch. I'm like, who knew? Right?
You just taught us all something.
So he kept this book. You know, that's why a lot of parents are afraid to have these hard conversations because they don't know the answers. Mm-hmm. But you know what? It's so cool to find those answers together and grow together, because it creates a bond, right? It creates safe space. It teaches your children that you don't have all the answers and you may need to do a looking up too. And it's okay for them to not have answers. And you get to learn and grow together. I mean, it's really cool. But, you know, the fact that your dad took time to explain to you, I think is pretty cool.
It is. And you know what? I'm going to take your why book with me, because Sebastian is asking a lot of whys. And I think as parents, you want to have an answer for them. You want to just be like, well, because the sky is blue.
You know? Like,
and that's, I love that approach, because it's how I work with my nutrition clients. I have no problem saying like, oh, I haven't worked at this disease state. Let me call this functional doctor, that functional doctor, and let me do a little research on PubMed to see what comes up for this diagnosis. But yeah. It's funny, as parents, you immediately want to be like, because Curious George said that, I don't know. It is so silly, but that really does teach your kids to be super curious, to know exactly what you said, and to know you don't have all the answers, to look for the answers, to ask the experts, to make you just a better person. Oh, so good.
And it makes them want to change things when they get older. They will be the kids that will say, wait a minute, just because we've been doing this the same for 50 years doesn't mean we still have to do that. Why are we still doing it this way?
Like, yeah.
They're going to be the ones that ask more questions to get things to change. Why is that law still effective? Why is that policy still excluding groups of people? You know,
right.
They're going to be the children to begin to change some of the systemic things that we're seeing in the world.
I love that. So what are some kid-friendly, like, activism things that we can start doing with our kids at a young age so that we create these change agents, these very curious kids who want to change the world and get rid of 50-year-old policies that aren't serving anyone?
Yeah, I think the easiest way, the best way to start is to think about the things that you're passionate about in your home. So look at, like for you, maybe it's nutrition, right? It's feeding your body well, taking care of your body, using food as fuel. Mm-hmm. And so those are the things that you want to tackle. Like, for example, my son is at Harvard, right? And I'm in the mom's parenting group. He's a freshman. He just got there. Mm-hmm. And everybody is saying about how surprised and disappointed they are how bad the food is. So, you know, parents are putting up like the ingredients of the food, and it's all of this chemical stuff in the food. And that's part of their plan, right? They're, sorry, Harvard. Yeah. But that's part of their, you know, the dining is part of their, is what we're paying for.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking about your family, like, right. So that would be something that you're, if you're passionate about that, now we need to write letters to Harvard, right? We need to start a petition on why that's not good. Maybe we need to do some research on what's in this thing, or what's the best things that we can eat. So that's just kind of popping to my mind. But use the things that you're passionate about to start making some changes in that area. So I think writing letters to different people is a great way. Your kids may not be able to write, but they can talk.
Right.
So tell them to tell you what changes they want to make or what they want to do. And you can write it out for them, or you can do it as a family. And also, I think the what they call portable projects could be a great start, right? Kids can't go and volunteer and do things in places because they're too young. But you could have like, let's have a party. Let's have five families over. We're going to collect diapers or Pampers or whatever it is that's needed in our local area, and we're going to contribute to that. And then the kids can box, they could be a part of that. The idea of paying for people behind you, I mean, that is, to me, that's activism. You are seeing that there may be a need and you're acting. And I think the other thing is just raising your kids at home to be aware that these things are going on in the world. So, right. You know, parenting itself is activism. And the things that we do in the behind closed doors in our house, in our homes, are the things that show up in the world. So I would say doing the little things inside your home really will prepare them to do whatever that is out in the world. And we want that to be good things.
Definitely. I have so many takeaways from today's episode and just like learning from you. Really, it's almost like I can picture your life. I picture this really safe home, this safe haven of just openness and safety for your children, that you're raising these very compassionate kids because you're practicing self-compassion yourself. And then with them, those hard boundaries so that they can get out in the world and do the same. I really love the four S's: self-reflection, survey, speak, and seek. I mean, those are the kind of actionable tools that I think we all need to go, okay, well, what are our core values as a family? Now let's look at the four S's. Are we aligning with our core values? Are we raising anti-racist children? Are we raising kids who are going to be change agents, who are going to be compassionate and kind to everyone, inclusive, and not to be afraid, even though it's emotionally charged, an emotionally charged topic, and like, that we can push through and have these hard conversations. Because I think that's exactly what you started with, which is it's fear parenting. It's we're afraid. It's easier not to turn the news on when they're around, or to try to protect them from things that aren't like the ugly underbelly of our nation. And instead we need to open it up surgically and deal with some stuff.
That's right. And we're going to get it wrong. I mean, I get it wrong too, still so many times with my kids, but right. Just don't give up. Don't be afraid to get it wrong. I mean, there are days that I'm like, are you getting what I'm giving? Like, are you showing up? Like, is this making sense to you? There's some days that my kids, I don't think they understand what I've been teaching them their whole lives. And then I'll see them out in public, or I'll hear another mom says, I love when your kid is around because they're so kind to my kid. Aww. So you may not always see it at home, but you know, if you're laying that foundation, keep doing it, even when it doesn't feel good, even when you're not sure, because it'll show up when it needs to show up.
So true. I feel like I obviously love to bring everything back to nutrition. It just is my, it's how I learn. It's my wheelhouse. And so when I learn something that isn't my expertise and isn't my wheelhouse, I always like to bring it back. And it is like all of the strategies that you've given us today and just your openness and the amazing book that you just wrote. Like it just, it brings me back to nutrition because it is, it's like, you may feed your kids a certain way and they might, you know, you might mess up and buy the sugary candy and get in the habit of buying that at the store a couple of times. And you're like, I got to walk it back. This isn't in line with my core values. And we got to have hard conversations and boundaries. And we understand that that's going to be a bummer not to have that anymore. But this is just not in alignment with what we're doing anymore. And it's all about what you're saying. It's those having compassion, having those hard conversations and sticking to your, having boundaries so that you stick to your core values.
Yes. Core values should bring you back every time. Yep.
All right. So how can people follow along, get the book, come take your course? I mean, I feel like this is all we need module one. We need to do our core values. What can we do? Where can we find you?
I think the best place to find me in terms of just activity is on Instagram.
Yeah.
At Social Justice Parenting. And then all of the other information about the courses, the book, are on my website too, and same name, www.socialjusticeparenting.com.
Thank you so much for all of your hard work. Thank you for writing your book and your courses and putting all of this good actionable information online for us, because it's what we need to feel comfortable having the hard conversations and using your four S's to create little change agents in the world.
Yes. Thank you, Kelly, for having me. I really enjoyed talking with you.
It was a really nice conversation. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Be Well by Kelly. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at bewellbykelly.com and follow me on Instagram at bewellbykelly. I would love if you picked up my books, Body Love and Body Love Every Day. They're sold on Amazon and at all major booksellers.